Why doesn't Canada respond? First, because, of course, we would have to condemn an ally, a partner in NATO. And that would be unpleasant, possibly unthinkable in diplomatic terms. Not just an ordinary partner either, but the indispensable one, the nation on the very doorstep of the country that's supposed to be our enemy. In these special circumstances, criticism of any sort, no matter how justified, is apparently intolerable to our pragmatic External Affairs Department. Turkey argues the merits of continued poppy growing, and we understand. Turkey runs roughshod over the helpless inhabitants of northern Cyprus, and who are we to pick sides? It's an internal matter. If you detect a certain inconsistency in our moral posturing, a certain hypocrisy in external affairs, don't let it bother you. If Turkish poppy growing is tacitly approved as legitimate commerce, but any kind of produce or product from Rhodesia is seen as unclean in the eyes of our federal government, we may be led to conclude that we practice a double standard. Nations necessary to our national interests can do no wrong. Only nations that aren't are subject to our moralizing and sanctions. Secondly, a belief that it's none of our business. It happened long ago and far away in a corner of a world filled with turmoil and in the middle of a great war. What has this to do with open and free and non-violent Canada as we see it in the 20th century? Let the dead bury the dead. Let those who choose to join the mainstream of Canadian life forget the past and focus on the future. What this suggests, of course, is that justice doesn't count as an ideal in our open, free society, and that no history is instructing except our own limited experience. We, in truth, have much to learn, and you who have lived so long, so richly, and so meaningfully have much to teach us. Thirdly, and perhaps this is the most important consideration, even though it's rarely voiced, there's the matter of our national conscience. Genocide is a terrible, the ultimate crime, the murder of an entire people. And any nation practicing it must be singled out and condemned. We all subscribe to that. But who among the major nations is without sin and able to cast the first stone? The United States? Consider the mass killing of Indians on the plains in the 19th century because they were in the way of progress. What difference in moral implication is there between the catchphrase, "The only good Indian is a dead Indian," and Abdul Hamid's, "The way to eliminate the Armenian question is to eliminate the Armenians"? Canada? Well, we of course didn't slaughter our Indians in wholesale lots. We signed treaties with them that merely robbed them of their land and their pride. Their social system condemned them to a fate worse than death. Is a long, lingering death, one that extends over generations, better or worse than a swift one? Britain, France, Germany, Russia, China, Spain, do any of these appear before us with unbloodied hands in their dealings with subject peoples and minorities in the long march of history? I'd suggest to you that whether they indicate it or not, those ministers you talk to in Ottawa each year and the government they represent consider soberly the dark possibilities should they see fit to deplore genocide too strongly. If modern Turkey is called on to answer for the sins of 1895 and 1915, by the same token, shouldn't modern Ottawa be held accountable for the treachery and terrorism practiced by federal authorities in 3 centuries of dealing with our own minorities? This, then, is the measure of your frustration. If no one is listening, if no one cares, how do you keep your cause vital and engage the attention and hopefully the conscience of the world? By revenge? Yes, I've heard it rationalized, and so have you many times, a guerrilla force, a campaign of terror, fighting fire with fire, a few murders, or as many as you must, to show the enemy you've not surrendered or succumbed, and force the world to know who you are and what you suffered. Well, with every respect to the advocates of violence, I say, please don't. If there's one thing the world doesn't need now, it's one more people resorting to bullet and bomb and the terror of ambush to press a cause. Catholic and Protestant extremists in Northern Ireland take revenge for old wrongs every day of the year. And I ask you, after these years of bloodshed, which is the villain and which the victim? Are Muslim leftists in Lebanon any more noble than Christian extremists? If both advocate sneak tactics and condone the death of innocents? No, the world doesn't need any more violence, nor can it be justified even when it succeeds. Bernard Lewis, the apologist for Turkish behavior, writing in commentary in January 1975, notes, quote, that more than half the members of the United Nations are governed by regimes that use murder and terror as normal instruments of administration and policy. Many respected members of the community of statesmen rose to power by murder and terror, end quote. Respected is an ill-advised adjective. In the ultimate court of judgment, we must all answer for the blood in our hands, nations as well as people. What the world does need, and desperately, is the example of one nation, one people, willing to renounce violence and terrorism in order to lead all people to a higher plane of wisdom, truth, peace, justice, and understanding, and in time, brotherhood. You are uniquely suited to that role. You have lived the full span of time. You have experienced every indignity known to man, and you have survived. You were the first of all nations to embrace the faith of the one who taught us to turn the other cheek, to love those who persecute us for his name's sake. It was Anatole France in 1916, as quoted by Archbishop Circassian last year, who wrote, "Armenia expires, but will be born again. The little blood that is left to it is a precious blood which generates an heroic posterity. A people who do not wish to die will not die." And adds the Archbishop, "The prophecy has been fulfilled. The Armenian nation lives and strives for greater service to mankind." The English poet William Cowper wrote these words many years ago about martyrs, and they seem fitting as we mark the solemnity of this day. To die for the truth is not to die merely for one's faith or one's country. It is to die for the whole world. Their blood is shed in confirmation of the noblest claim, the claim to feed upon immortal truth, to walk with God, and to be divinely free. May God keep their memory in your hearts. May God bless you.
Armenia at a very young age, after having witnessed the horror and the oppression of the Turkish massacre against the Armenians. Now, what one would ask, what was the fault of the Armenians? Just religious differences. Armenians were the first Christian nation. And consequently, in Turkey, there has one genocide after the other. Sadly enough for me, I was among the early witness of the massacres in 1914, 1918. So at the age of 6 or 7, I witnessed this horror. But I had a remarkable mother. I always refer to her as perhaps one of the finest Christian ever. At the age of 7, I went from our constantly interrupted schools by the Turks, going home. But the children of Turkish families tried to search our pockets, little children. Now, what could we have in our pocket at the age of 6 or 7? Few marbles, but they mean a lot to us, to anyone. So I resisted giving these marbles to the Turkish children. So they went and stoned me. They threw a stone on my forehead. I was bleeding. And I rushed to my home, to my mother defiantly, and I said, from now on, I will be the one who will carry stones. So my mother took me closer to her, said, son, do you really think they know what they are doing? However, if you have to retaliate in self-defense, be sure you miss. Do not come to their level. And ever since then, I have learned not to hate. So you can imagine what a heritage this is, what a great gift to me. So that I came at the age of 14 to my uncle in Sherbrooke, Uncle George Nakash, who was a photographer, but with the hope that my mother's desire and mine was to be a physician. But to come at the age of 14, totally lacking in academic training, but I may say so, armed with splendid manners, manners that I considered all people around and very, ever so politely. So my uncle sent me to school for 2 terms, and much to my good fortune, the first days in school, it was raining in Sherbrooke, snowing, so we had to play games in school. And what were those games? Marbles. But the first handful of marbles was given to me by one of the boys. They saw to it that I won so that I may keep them. What a great contrast. And ever that first day in school in Sherbrooke, Quebec, I have been the recipient of much kindness, much consideration. And the first week or two, I began to be invited to their home. And this cemented my love, my gratitude for Canada.